All right, and please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Ricky D. from the Stepping Stones Group in Philly.
My name's Rick, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Lauren for asking me to come out tonight and speak. Congratulations on your 12th year anniversary. It's pretty cool. This is the first meeting that I went to that was an hour speaker meeting, and my sponsor spoke at it. And it was pretty cool. It was outside. It was down in the pavilion, and I was only a little bit sober. And I was like, I couldn't wrap my head around an hour speaker meeting. I was like, what do you mean I can't share? He's like, no, you're not sharing. I'm like, I don't want to go now. Because I have to share, you know. And it was a pretty cool meeting. There was horses over there, and I was really taken back by the crowd. There was a whole lot of people here, and they're all in lawn chairs and playing wiffle ball before the meeting. It was pretty cool. And I have a sobriety date. My sobriety date is November 29th of 2005, and I have a sponsor. His name's Chris, and I get the honor and privilege of sponsoring other guys, taking other guys through the 12 steps. And my home group is the Stepping Stones. It's an inner city clubhouse, so there's a lot of meetings there. But I do go there a lot. But the meeting I'm active in is a Saturday night meeting, which is an hour speaker meeting. And I love this format because I get to come in to my home group on a Saturday night, and I get to be still for an hour, and I get to hear a message, and I get to see the power of God and the power of the 12 steps working in someone's life, and I can't carry the message to myself. So I go there, and it's awesome. I get there early, and I help set up and put the coffee on, and I'm not proud of the home group, because that means I had something to do with it. I'm very grateful for it, because it doesn't need me. I need it. And that's where I get the fellowship that I crave in there. And I'm looking around this meeting, a lot of young guys and a lot of young girls. And my home group is all young kids. It's all young kids and all young people. And the young people that are, young people are the future, are the lifeblood of Alcoholics Anonymous. But those young bucks that carry the message in my home group are the heartbeat. Like all lifeblood needs a heartbeat. And them young kids are on fire, and they're carrying a message, and you go there before the meeting and they're doing stat work on the side, they're outside in the car doing stat work, and there's big books open, and I know I'm home. And you know, there's only a couple of things that I've realized in the last 12 years. I'm sober a little over 12 years, and I don't know a whole lot. I really don't. I'm unlearning a lot of stuff, and it's painful. It's painful sometimes. And it's just it's young learning of stuff in here that it's the journey. Like I'm already on the path. There's nowhere to go. Looking around, there's nowhere to go. We're here, and it's the path, you know. And in that home group, I can't say enough about that. I know that the 12 steps don't keep me sober, and my sponsor doesn't keep me sober. He doesn't even really like me very much. I know the big book doesn't keep me sober. I know the service doesn't keep me sober. It's all those things combined. It's the big book, my sponsor, the guys I work with, and service to a home group and the fellowship. All that stuff has carried me to and place me in a position of trusting a power called God that does. And I never knew that. I thought I knew what AA was. I knew about sobriety. I really didn't know a whole lot. I brought nothing here. My first AA meeting was in 1999. I brought nothing to the table. I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous in 2005, and I still brought nothing to the table. And anything good in my life is because of you guys. Because alcohol beat me into a state of reasonableness. When someone gets beaten down the way alcohol beat me down, because something happens in my anatomy, that when my butt gets kicked, my ears open up. And I could hear somebody for the first time. My first sponsor, Danny, he carried the message to me. He wasn't afraid to hurt my feelings. He wasn't afraid to tell me the truth. And my current sponsor is the same way, and I'll always be grateful for that. And there's some young kids that I work with and some young girls that I hang out with, and they have absolute spiritual consent to call me on my crap whenever they seem that I need it. You know? And, I don't have a war story. When you drink enough vodka and take enough Quaaludes, you don't remember too much. I don't remember much of my life. I really don't. And I picked up a drink at 14 years old. And I didn't plan on drinking. I didn't know I was going to make a decision that night that was going to change my life forever, and it did. Alcohol worked for me for 28 years. Now, I sponsor some kids that never even drank at a bar. I'm like, man, you got gypped. They didn't even have a home bar. Like, I had a home bar. So in AA, I have a home group. Same thing. And Alcoholics Anonymous has blessed me. What it did for my family, if my mom was here, she's 94 years old, if she was here, if you had about 6 hours to kill, she would tell you all about what Alcoholics Anonymous did for our family. You know, I picked up a drink at 14, and I was down Wildwood, down the shore. I spent most of my summers down the shore. We had a shore house. And my cousin came up to me. She was 19, and she was babysitting us. I had little cousins that were like 10 and 11, and it was her turn to babysit us. And she said, "You're drinking tonight." I never seen anybody drunk. I never held a beer in my hand. I didn't know anything about drinking. And I said, "Whatever. I would do anything my cousins asked me to do to fit in." So all I wanted to do was just fit in, and I couldn't. Remember, I'm 14 years sober at this time. From the time my mom gave birth to the time I took my first drink, I was 14 years sober. And nothing, no mood or mind altering substances in me, and it was awkward. I didn't do puberty well. I don't know if anybody really does. But I just didn't do it well. It was so awkward. I had long, greasy hair. I had pimples all over my face. My legs looked like toothpicks. I couldn't talk to girls, and I wanted to, and I just couldn't. And we went under the boardwalk, and they gave me a quart of Budweiser. We didn't have 40s back then. And I drank a lot of it. I didn't even drink the whole quart. And something happened inside of me. I didn't know it at the time. I'm looking back now, as my sponsor took me through step one. I'm looking back on it, and every day, our whole family, I grew up in a big Italian Catholic family, so it was like, there was like 40 of us on the beach. We had like territory on the beach. And I would run back to, right around 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock, I would run back to the house and get on my bike and ride to Morey's Pier. And I would look at that white wooden roller coaster, big giant wooden roller coaster. It made this awesome noise. And I just used to stare at it. And I was too afraid to go on it. Whenever we were on the boardwalk at nighttime with my family and my cousins, I'll say, no, I'll hold the jackets and the pocketbooks. You guys go have fun. I've been on it so many times. It's good. And I never did. I'll tell you what, that night, I drank the Budweiser. I went on twice. That's what alcohol does for me. If anybody's ever been to your first sober dance, and you're like, yes, you can't move, that's how my whole life was until I drank. And I didn't drink every day and lose my paper route down in Wildwood. There was no consequences. But I knew, and I didn't drink the next weekend or the following weekend, but I knew I was going to go back to that. I knew that there was something that would fix this internal sickness that I suffer from. This, you know, this thing inside of me that I just couldn't connect with other people. And I have a few shots of vodka and a couple of Budweiser's. I can come out and play. It's powerful. That's why it's so hard to get separated from it. And, I didn't lose the paper route. And about 16 or 17, I started playing football and hockey and softball for a bar my brother went to. My brother was older than me. And I started playing softball in the bar I would sponsor. And they would bring me in the back door, sitting on a table in the back, and they would bring me pitchers of beer. And they would say, just sit back here. And I'll tell you what caught my eye was the bartender and the barmaid. I said, that looks like a fun job. So 2 years later, that same bar I got a job at. A friend of mine had bought it. He was only a couple years older than me. And he knew I was at that age where I'm 18 in 3 years. All my friends, I hung out with a big crowd in inner city Philadelphia. All my friends were coming in drinking and playing softball and football for that bar. So it was a business move. And I said, sure, I'm in. And I started a bartending at nighttime. And during the day, I worked for a beer distributor. My uncle owned a beer distributor in Philly. And I started driving a beer truck. So my whole life was saturated around alcohol. I would drive the beer truck during the day and bartend at night. And in Bill's story, when it says, we've arrived, man, You know how much power I had at 18 years old? And this bar was a bar, restaurant, slash nightclub. So at 9 o'clock at night, they had a DJ or a band with big giant bouncers, and they're at my disposal. So if you didn't tip, you weren't getting in. Simple as that. If you didn't tip, you weren't getting waiter. I learned very early who the tippers were and who the tippers were not. And, you know, if you came in with your boyfriend, he's getting tossed out too. Lower the odds a little bit. And then I met a girl there. And her dad met my dad, and that's never good. And he said, if you're going to marry my daughter, you're going to get a real job. I'm like, I got a real job. I make more than you do. And he's like, no, you're going to get a job with benefits. So him and my dad got together, and they got me a job at City Hall in Philly, and I worked for a judge. It was the greatest job in the world. You could never get fired from it unless you put your hands on somebody or you didn't show up. I worked there 10 years, but my very first day I worked there, they weren't doing it right. The city of Philadelphia has been around since 1774, I believe, something like that. And here it is, 1985. Man, you ain't doing it right. I worked for a judge in a court. The day was way too long. So I would just keep moving cases in and out, and I would just cancel cases on my own. And I would just call up defendants and witnesses and say, your court cases continue to this date. Next thing you know, we get done at 11 o'clock. And a judge wonders what happened to his caseload. Because they get paid. He was a senior judge. He gets paid by the case. And he was losing money because of me. He didn't like that very much. So needless to say, I didn't last that job very long. And then I got a job with the state of Pennsylvania, which I upgraded. In my drinking, I got actually upgraded. I got a job with the state. And at this job is where things went south, is when we suffered from a progressive illness. And my drinking just took off. And this place was not the breeding ground for spiritual development. This place was drinking, and there was a lot of drugs, and there was 2,500 people working in this building. And it was fun. And I was a painter who was not allowed to paint. All I could do was clean brushes. Because it's hard to paint when your hands are shaking in the morning. And they recognized that. They didn't care. They said, just put drop cloths down. And when we whistled, just move the scaffolding. We were painting a building at Broad and Spring Garden State Building. And we were painting the underbelly of the building, the big giant overhang. And my job was just to push the scaffolding, like three blocks, like three cement blocks. It was like 9 feet every half hour. And I couldn't even do that right. And one time I pushed a little too far, and I pushed them right out in the middle of Broad Street. And the guys all up on the scaffold, they didn't like that very much. And they went and told my boss that I had a problem. I had a drinking problem. And my boss came to me, and they offered me either rehab or you lose your job. And I took rehab. So in 1999, I went in my first rehab. And I went into rehab, never drinking again. I'm done. Stayed there 36 days. Came out, never went to a meeting. I came out, and I just didn't drink for a little bit. And eventually, I drank again. And it just kept every year. I was in a rehab every year after that. And I was in Friends Hospital, Horsham Clinic. I was in there three times each, you know. And every time I was in there, I always say to myself, I'm never drinking again. I'm done. And as soon as I would come out, something would just start turning in my head. Like, go get a drink. Make you feel better. And I was, so in second and third rehab, I started to make some meetings. And I didn't like AA very much. It was very strange. It was a lot of older guys. I was 35. Most of the guys were in their 60s and their 70s, and there was nothing. And I just didn't want to. I felt like I was being sentenced to go to AA, and I didn't like it. And I worked Step Zero from 1999 to 2005. I worked Step Zero beautifully. Step Zero is when time I make my first meeting until I actually open up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and start going through the process with a man who's been here before me. So I got the results of Step Zero beautifully. And at one time in those 6 years, I had managed to get 13 months of continuous sobriety. I was living in a halfway house in Philly, and there were drug tests and breathalyzing every other day. I was scared to death to drink, scared to death to do anything, and that fear kept me sober for a minute. But the minute I moved out of there, I stayed there for a year. So 30 days later, I was sober 13 months. And this is how painful sobriety is. I wasn't even living with my parents. I walked in my parents' house and hung myself in their bathroom. That's what 13 months of untreated, unchecked, unaccountable for sobriety looks like in my life. And people were telling me, put a drink down, you'll feel better. No, it's not my experience. That is not my experience. I put a drink down, the more crazier, and my insides just keep turning, and my head puts the screws in, and I get nailed to the wall, and then I drink again. And then people say, you don't want it bad enough. I said, I've been in 13 treatment centers. I don't want to drink. Tell me how to not drink. And they said, keep coming back. I kept coming back, and I kept drinking. And they weren't trying to hurt me. They didn't know how to help me. And I knew nothing about alcoholism. And this is what my last day drinking looked like, November 28th of 2005. I'm panhandling up at Roosevelt Boulevard and Red Line Road. I don't know how I got there. I just come out of, I drank, hung myself sober, drank, got locked up. I got locked up in a tuxedo. And so I came out of jail in a tuxedo, and my parents and my girlfriend threw all my clothes out. So that's what I owned. I owned a tuxedo. And both elbows were ripped out, both knees were ripped out. I had one sock and two different kind of black shoes on. And it was snowing. I had blood coming down here. I had the black crack hands that went across like this. It reeked the booze. And I'm panhandling. And if you're like me, I don't like the panhandle. It's a lot of work. I just ask for fives. I don't even ask for change. And so I'm making my sales pitch to this girl. I'm going right for her, and she takes one look at me, and she had another little girl with her about this big. I guess it was her daughter. I don't have kids, so I guess she was a 3 or 4 year old. And she seen me coming. And the way I looked, I haven't bathed or shaved the whole time I was in jail. I was in there for months. And she got that little girl by her ears, and she threw her in the back seat. And she didn't have automatic locks, so she had to turn and lock each door by hand. And every time she hit the door lockdown, it just got louder. When they say the gates of hell clanged, I get that. And as she backed out, almost running me over, I caught my reflection in her window, in her back window. The little girl was looking at me, terrified. And something happened in that moment where I seen myself. I'm like, oh, that's not me. We'll have this happen again. And my idea was to walk to the boulevard and just throw myself in front of the next bus or truck. And I made a phone call to my buddy Vic, who never would answer his phone. That was going to be my excuse. I called AA. He didn't answer the phone. On the phone, he's always helping people, but they ain't helping me. Right? So what I did was I called and he answered. And there's the first God shot. He never answered his phone back then. And he said, get to my house. I'm like, you know where I'm at? Red Line Boulevard. He lives by the Stepping Stones. It's 8.9 miles. And he said, get to my house if you want help. I said, well, that's awful cruel. Would you come pick me up? He said, I'm working. I have a job. I'm working in Glassboro, New Jersey. By the time you get to my house, I'll meet you there. And I'll feed you and get you something to eat. And I knocked on his door. I got there. It took me like 8 hours to get there. And I actually cut off in the Penny Pack Park. I'm saying, ah, screw AA. I'll just eat berries and hunt deer. And I lasted like 30 seconds. And it was snowing. It was one of them snows where the snowflakes were like this big and one would wet your whole head. I was just soaking wet. And he took one look at me. He took one look at me and he said, dude, you ain't living here looking like that. But I have a house around the corner that you can live in if you want, but you can't drink. See, me and him had our sobriety dates were a couple days apart, my old sobriety date, a couple days apart, and I drank, he didn't. And when I relapsed, it scared the crap out of him, and now he became a big book guy. And that's not what you want to hear or see when you're detoxing, you need a drink. And he walked around the corner to this house, and if you're like me, you notice one thing as soon as you walk into a house that's unfurnished, but it's all brand new, it's beautiful. You noticed the copper. I'm like, I can hang here for a minute. And he's, I know what you're thinking. He's here, but you're so weak. You got a paper wristband on your hand from CFCF, which is the county jail on State Road in Philly. And you're too weak to pull it off your hand. And if you want to take the copper, go ahead, I'll even give you a pipe wrench. He said, but I don't think you will. Hell, you don't know who I am. I'll take all of it. And he left. Now I'm in this house, and I don't know what to do with myself. He said, tomorrow I'll bring you a TV. And there was a love sheet for a five-year-old. It was about this big. That was my bed for a week. And he left. Another member of Alcoholics Anonymous came in and started my journey. So I thought my journey here started with step one, but it never did. It started with step 12, ingrained in the heart of somebody else. And he came up those steps with two big books. I'm like, ugh. I'm here to offer you spiritual help. Oh, yeah? You know what spiritual help would look like right about now? $4,500, a lawyer. If you get me a job where I can start at 90K, and if your girlfriend has a friend that would date me, that would be spiritual help. And he said, no. Nope. He said, I've been watching you for 13 months, Rick. He said, you know how to make meetings, but your insides are still dirty. Then he asked me a question, is why I'm still here today. He said, do you think drinking's your problem, or do you think sobriety's your problem? I said, drinking. And he lit up a cigarette, and I'm like, dude, you can't smoke in the house. He's like, it's not even your house. I said, it's my house. That's what I heard. I heard that was my house. And he walked outside. He got what every good sponsor wants. He got me to follow him. I said, what's that, the wrong answer? I said, I just relapsed, burnt my life down to the ground again. He's here, I'll ask it to you again. Do you think drinking's your problem, or do you think sobriety's your problem? I said, drinking. Then he walked away from me again. And he started walking to his car with the two big books. I'm like, where are you going? Did I give you the wrong answer? He said, absolutely. He said, think about it. You had 13 months of continuous sobriety, and you picked up a drink from a sober state. How can drinking be your problem? Sobriety is your problem. Ugly, miserable, untreated, unchecked, unaccountable for sobriety. And you suffer from a spiritual malady that wants you dead. I'm like, it's the first time I ever heard that. So I invited him back into the house. And I was feeling he was getting snowed on, so I said, come on in the house. And he handed me the big book, and I slid it across the floor, because there was no seats. We were sitting on the floor. And I slid it across the floor into the kitchen, and he's there, how old are you? Right? And he said, before I leave, because I am leaving, I'll go help somebody that wants it. He said, go upstairs in that bathroom and look. Ask yourself if you're okay. Now, remember, I had just hung myself a couple months before that. And if you're in the Pennsylvania Penal Code, the doctors ain't ready to see, especially if you're detoxing from an alcohol and drugs. There's no medical attention being given to you. So I look like a cat. I didn't even know I looked like that. All I've seen was my reflection in this crap on my face. I went upstairs in the mirror. I looked at myself in the mirror. I looked like a cat. I had like whiskers coming out of my forehead. I had broken both eye sockets, and my chin was split open. I had a big giant rope burn on my neck. And I looked at myself in the mirror. I just broke down. And as I cried, the blood just came out. All the stitches came open. All the scabs broke open. And it looked like a crime scene in the bathroom. And I came back down the steps. And I grabbed onto him, like a dying man could. And I wiped my bloody face all over his white Penn State hoodie. And now I got a tuxedo over the hoodie. That's one way to get clothes. Wipe the blood on somebody. He took it off, went here. And I thought just not drinking was the answer. But I know that not drinking is not the treatment for alcoholism. Because my alcoholism is between the drinks. My alcoholism starts when the bottles and the bags are empty. That was news to me. And so he opened the big book up, and I couldn't even read it. I was detoxing. I needed a drink bad. And he started to give me the doctor's opinion in step one, and he rolled out. It's about 11 o'clock at night now, and I'm pacing back and forth, knowing I just had a first step experience, half sober, half drunk. And I knew I was going to drink again. I didn't want that. So I fell asleep in that love seat, and that guy, Danny, and I know it was even worse. He was younger than I was. And he was happier than I was. I didn't know what he had. I just know I didn't want what I had any longer. And he started this journey through 12 steps. That just something inside of me. Because it usually happens to me is I'm the kind of guy that you, If I'm walking Kensington Avenue, there is 100% alcohol. I'm 100% alcoholic. I get it. See, there's a part in how it works that I'm an alcoholic and I can't manage my own life, drunk or sober. I always forget when I'm sober, I'm still an alcoholic. And I don't want to suffer from the delusion that maybe someday I'll be like other people, like my brother and sister who aren't. And I didn't know any of this stuff. And that step one catapulted me through the rest of these steps is why I'm still here today, because my life depends upon every action that I take in these rooms. The more I serve you guys, the more peaceful I get. The more I serve myself, the darker I get. I didn't know that happiness will always follow being useful. And he came back over, and there was a new meeting at the Stones, and he said, go over to the new meeting and make coffee. I'm like, no, you make coffee. He said, boy, your wilderness went away real quick. So we're over Stones. I started to make coffee. And I started to go there every day at noon. So it was unemployable, since I only had a tuxedo to wear. I went there every day at noon. I started to meet some old timers. Because this time around, the outsides didn't clean up. Every other time, the other six, seven times I relapsed in them sobriety, the outsides cleaned up, but the insides stayed dirty. And there's a weirdness that happens with me. When I'm walking Kensington Avenue, my outside's dirty, my inside's dirty. There's a continuity about that. There's a level of that. Then when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I go in some halfway house or some recovery house, and the outsides clean up, but the insides are still dirty. It doesn't feel right. Something doesn't feel right. And I knew I had the wherewithal to recognize this in my last few times of relapse, and that something's missing here. All my friends are not drinking and they're happy. I'm not drinking and I'm miserable. I don't compare myself to anybody else in the Alcoholics Anonymous. I compare myself to that first step, 6 and 7, 10, 11, and 12. I compare myself to the 12 steps. I don't compare myself to myself, because if I do that, I was better off at 6 months sober than I am right now. Only I could do that. On paper, I was worth more at 6 months sober than I am right now. I'm quite okay with that. I'm not being driven by money. I ain't driven by sex. I ain't driven by property, prestige, or anything else. I had a sponsor who told me what's going to drive me. That's our primary purpose. And then that fourth step, something happened. In that fourth step, something happened that I can't explain. For the first time, I saw me on paper. I saw what my life looked like on paper. I saw what kind of son I was. I saw what kind of human being I was, basically. What kind of boyfriend I'd been. What kind of coworker. What kind of employee. I blamed everybody else. See, I was playing a victim for 6 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and what I know today is victims never recover. And when I shine the spotlight on you guys, I get sicker. When I shine that spotlight on the inside, I get better. And I can't play that victim no more. And So it made step nine really easy. So I saw my mistakes in every relationship, every resentment that I had, and made step nine easy. Had to go back and make amends to those parents. My parents are 94 years old. And had to make amends to those parents that stood by me for so long. I'm the kind of guy that puts mom against dad, brother against sister, nieces against nephews to keep the deflection away from me. That's what I did to my family. How many Christmases I ruined? Like Christmas tree through bow windows. Like that's not, my cousin still won't forgive me for that. You know? But the nieces and nephews were all grown up now. Remember that incident. They tell it every year. You know? And I introduced my parents to a level of living that no human being should ever be introduced to. I stole everything from them. Not only material stuff, their peace of mind. I stole their serenity. Stole their spirituality. Stole their emotions. You know, the only time they went on vacation is when I was locked up or in a Horsham clinic, because you couldn't just walk out of places, Friends Hospital. If I was in rehab, they couldn't go. I couldn't walk out of rehab. And I turned my mom into a liar. My mom never lied in her life. Because when I was locked up or in a psych ward, there was weddings and funerals and birthday parties and Christmases. And where's Rick at? Oh, he's working. Didn't even have a job. And I had a sponsor, and he said, call me up on a Saturday morning. And he asked a magic question: are you hungry? You know, I'm living in a recovery house. I'm not working. I'm starving. He says, let's go get something to eat. He picks me up about 10 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, Saturday morning. And it was freezing cold out. And we drove up Cottman Avenue, right past the Four Seasons Diner and McDonald's. Made it right on the boulevard, and there's Tiffany's Diner. I'm like, dude, we ain't going to eat, are we? He's like, nope. Went to my parents' house to make amends. See, he actually followed our big book. He got in touch with my parents. My parents had a restraining order against me, but I had 5 minutes to make my amends. I had 5 minutes. The cops were on speed dial. 911 was on speed dial. I walk in the house, and my dad has the inquiry. Took one look, folded the paper down, took one look at me, folded the paper, and walked out of the room. My mom says, you have 4 minutes and 35 seconds. What do you have to say? I made my amends to my mom, and I'll tell you what, my mom was 84 at the time. No, she was 82 at the time, and she was very, very sick. My mom has not been sick since. She has Alzheimer's, but that's a mental. She's not been physically sick, because what happens to us is when we do things to our family and friends, our insides knot up. Emma Fox always talks about how our glands govern our emotions govern our well-being. And my mom was knotted up, and she hasn't been sick since. And she said, yeah, one minute. I said, what can I do to make this right, Mom? And she says, just keep going to them classes. Don't drink. Even my mom knows that not like drinking isn't good. Don't drink. And be part of the family. See, that part, being part of the family, didn't happen right away. It took almost 7 years to get back in the family. Like I said, my cousin, who I wrecked her Christmas twice, not just once, the Christmas tree not pushed over through the window, because we're fighting over Eagles and the Cowboys. All right. And in about 5 months sober, I moved out of recovery house, and I got my own apartment, and life was good. And the house is now one of 11 recovery houses. And I got an opportunity to run those for a little while. Almost killed me, but I got an opportunity to run them and be part of it. And it's an experience I needed at that time. It kept me busy with Alcoholics Anonymous, with new guys. It kept me connected to the new guy. And I got this apartment. I got a cat. I never liked animals. I don't know where that came from. And somebody handed me a little kitten here. Well, okay, take it. And for about 9.5 years, things went smooth. I had a friend of mine always says, you better do the work before you need it. I didn't know what that meant. This time of the year, 3 years ago, I didn't look good. My buddy Vic and his girlfriend lived downstairs. I would go outside, and if I hear him come in, I'll run down and just talk with him or whatever. And his girlfriend said to me, you don't look good. I'm like, either do you. I'm like, you don't look good. She's like, you don't look good. I'm like, all right. I work outside all day long. So in March, if it's nice weather, I'll have a tan by April. And she's like, last week you were tan and dark. You looked healthy. This week you're white as a ghost. You feel okay? I'm like, I feel fine. About a month later, I woke up in the middle of the night. I wasn't feeling so good. And I went to the hospital. It's either go to the hospital or she was calling my mom. When my mom gets called, stuff happens. So I went to the hospital on my own volition, and I was diagnosed with cancer. I was in stage 3 testicular cancer. And if any of you guys are praying for your lust to be removed, stop it. Unless you're prepared to go any length. And I was diagnosed with stage 3 testicular cancer. And they took my testicles, they took my breast, and they took my hip. I went through 5 surgeries in about 5 months. And I'll tell you what, you guys showed up. And the day I went into the hospital, my 2 biggest fears came true in 30 seconds. You have cancer and you're having surgery next week. Sober surgery and cancer. I'm like, how did this even happen? And I did what you guys taught me. I got off into a classroom, I hit my knees, and I said, God, this will never change our relationship. This ain't never going to change us. I got up off my knees. I went to that doctor like he was my sponsor. I said, what do I got to do? And my friends showed up. My friends had a copybook, and I was in Fox Chase every other day for a month before they actually operated on. And the day I went in for my first surgery, if you'd opened my refrigerator in my apartment, you would have found 2 things in my refrigerator, a battery an empty pizza box. That's what had been my refrigerator. When I came home, there was enough food to feed 100 people. Because 100 people came through my apartment at one time or another. I woke up one night, there's parents I never even met before on my couch. I'm like, what? Did I know you? I know they just gave me the Lauded in there for the surgery. Now I'm, and the best thing about this is, coming out of the hospital, there was no pain pills. Either the scalpels are really sharp today, or the power of God. I think it's the power of God moving me through that, because each surgery, we went into prayer and meditation with my friends. I was prepared. And they gave me non-narcotic Toradol to take home. And I'm like, do I know these guys? So, will you help? You sponsor our son. I'm like, we bought you some food. See, I'm the kind of guy, I won't take that. I'm the kind of guy that, how do you ask for help and not look like you need it? That's art form. So I haggle with him. Oh, I'm good. Let's take it away. Now. I'm like, and inside I'm going, please don't take it. Please don't take it. I'm hungry. And I turned my life upside down. And for about two weeks, my life hung in the balance. I don't know if I was going to live or die. And I'll tell you what, they're the best 2 weeks of my sobriety. Probably the best 2 weeks of my life. Because I totally and fully trusted and relied upon God for those 2 weeks. And the minute the surgery was successful and the chemotherapy was successful, right back in it again. Get my hands on stuff and it turns to crap. But for those 2 weeks, and I'm still living blood test to blood test. I don't know if I'm going to be here next month. And it changed everything. And about a year after that, my dad had a stroke. And we go up to the hospital. I'm in a meeting and I get a text message from my sister. Dad's in the hospital. And then another long message came back. He had a stroke and the diagnosis and the prognosis. So I go up to the hospital and it's like we're in this little room that holds maybe three people. And there's like 60 of us in there. Well, every relative I ever knew was in this room. And my mom says, everyone's talking. You really can't hear nothing. My mom looks at me, and she walks over to me, and she says, isn't it time you came home to help us? Yeah, everyone heard that. I'm like, huh? She's like, I haven't lived home since I'm 17 years old. I got a beautiful apartment in the city, 3 minutes from my home group. I could just walk to it in 3 minutes, but I always drive. And my mom says, it's time for you to come home. I'm like, no. Oh. But my head went like this. I said, okay. So what I did was I got my sponsor said, give all your stuff away. I'm like, no, you give your stuff away. Is there anything you haven't worn in the last 3 months, just give it to the guys in the recovery house. I'm like, no. He's like, just do it. Watch what happens. And that's exactly what happened. It was just basically more out of laziness than anything, than being altruistic. I said, for like packing everything. I said, here, guys. And they took all my furniture. They took every utensil I had in the recovery house. And I moved back in with my parents. Wouldn't experience that. And I don't have kids. It's like having five-year-old twins. They're both 94. They both have Alzheimer's. My mom, on my birthday, my sister came over to wish me happy birthday. My mom says, it's not your birthday. What are you doing? Your mom tells you it's not your birthday. It's not my birthday then. I'm like, okay, Mom. And the doctors wanted us to give her things to do. So I gave her some shirts to iron, and they disappeared for about 3 months. I went to the refrigerator to get some ice cream one night, and there's my shirts in the freezer. All right. But see, what she was doing was she was reverting back to 1940s, when people froze or got their clothes cold. It was easier to iron. But I guess she forgot about them. It's going to be a cold night tonight. And I said, okay. And then, you know, my dad's wearing my clothes, and it's beautiful. And I get to be a son that I never was. I get to be the person I never was. And I was talking to Amber today. Like, I made him dinner. Like, pat me on the back. Like, no, that's what you're supposed to do. And I take him out. And they want to come to a class, a meeting with me one night. And if it was so far away, I might have brought him tonight. But it's been, what a journey that's been, watching them. And I'm not raising them up. I'm raising them to go home. And every day it gets more painful. That's the conveyor belt of life. No one's exempt from that. You know, every day is different. You know, the conveyor belt of life comes around. Sometimes, some days are extraordinary. Other days are ordinary. Some days are full of pain. Some days are peaceful. Some days are just full of suffering. Other days are just full of silence. And that's the conveyor belt. Our kids are going to get sick. Our parents are going to get sick. Our friends. I found several of my sponsees dead. And when we die, it's not like we're at peace. We just drop right down. And when you see a sponsee with a broken neck and two broken arms behind his back because he fell out right where he was, just some painful stuff that happens. And we move all, and the beautiful thing here is we move all through that without thinking about a drink. And the miracle is I haven't drank all through 12, I can't even believe I'm 12, over 12 years sober. The miracle is I haven't drank. The miracle is I haven't thought about drinking. I like opiates. And I remember the nurse came out and said, "Here, pick six." I'm like, I don't want anything. She went, "What, are you kidding me?" I'm like, "Nope." I said, "I came here 11 years ago looking for the same drugs and you wouldn't give them to me." I said, "So take them back." So I don't want them. I'll tell you what, that's not me. The beautiful thing here is we bond. I have some sponsees are 18, 19 years old, and they just kill me. One of my sponsees was speaking out in New York, and we were on a road trip. And I love going on road trips. Every time we get out of Philadelphia, is always good. And they take my phone, and they put the Bluetooth on, and they put on the rap music. And usually by the time I get to the 20 miles away, I'm going to scrape my head along the sidewalk. But I pretend like I like it. But I pretend like I like it because they like it. I'm trying to put my spiritual game face on. And you know, that was a Friday night. And a Saturday morning, I go to around. I was just in my apartment, not doing much. It was like November. It was cold out. And there was nothing happening like sports-wise. It was like a Saturday afternoon. The college games were just wrapping up, and there was nothing to do. So I went around the Stepping Stones just to chill out, hang out, go to a meeting at 11 o'clock. And there's this young kid in there. I've been trying to get him to ask me to sponsor him for a month, and he was not buying in. I would say, "Yeah, you want to go through a step? Not with you." I'm like, "All right." And so it was freezing cold, and he said, "Hey, Rick, can you give me a ride back to the recovery house?" I said, "Yeah, sure." So something happened. I had my phone in my painter's pants, and something happened when I turned the car on. The Bluetooth kicked in, and Meek Mills came on. And the kid looked up at me and he goes, "You listen to Meek?" I'm like, "Yup." I don't. But that was his interest was music. And I had to get, I do. And I started, he went into Wawa, I started Googling stuff, and he was having a battle with other rapper, and I told him about that. He's like, "Damn." And I dropped him off. He said those magic words. He said, "Can you help me through the 12 steps?" I said, "Absolutely." He's sober a few years now, and he has a baby, getting a house built in Jersey. It's bad when your sponsees do better than you do. He's getting married, got a great union job, and, you know, and that's the thing. If any of you guys or girls want to have babies, see, God saw I couldn't have FIP because of my testicular cancer. I couldn't have babies ever. Every one of my sponsees got pregnant, got their girlfriend pregnant. I got 13 sponsee babies. I'll tell you what, it's expensive. It's really expensive. And I was getting girls to get me to sponsor their boyfriend so they can have babies. Like, "Yeah, is there anything I can do to help?" "Sure." And see, God saw fit that I couldn't have it, and I had my own little AA family. Because my family didn't come back in my life for a long time. And you guys are my family. I'll go to the Northeast Club, I'll go to the Last Stop, I'll go to the Stones, life or death, I'll just hang. Nothing to do. I'll just hang. See, but all those years, there's two things I haven't been. I've been a lot of things. I wish I was a better AA member, and I'm not. I wish I hadn't done some of the things that I've done, but I did. I've been angry and resentful and afraid. I've been ornery in business meetings, but I haven't been bored or lonely. If you're lonely, Start sponsoring some guys. You will wish that you were alone. Right? And if you're bored in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're doing it wrong. That's just been my experience. I was bored for 6 years in AA. I haven't been bored since I met my sponsor. He took me, because he packed me in a car, he'd take me places, and I'm like, are you supposed to buy me stuff? You know, and my first sponsor, Danny, he cared more about the name in the front of the jersey than the name on the back. And he actually practiced these principles. He said, you get 60 days sober, I'll buy you toiletries. Now, I'm using prison toiletries and handouts. People are just like giving me like their used soap from home. And I'm like, I need some Axe. He said, at 60 days sober, I'll take you on a shopping spree to Walgreens. I'm going to give you $40. You run in, run out. So 60 days, I let him know when it was. And we went to Walgreens, and it was pouring rain. It was one of those, like, cold rains. And there's a parking spot right in front of Walgreens. And I said, look, Spot, go grab it. And he made a left and went up Frankfurt Avenue, two blocks, in pouring rain. He handed me $40, and he goes, I said, God's good, Spot. And he handed me $40. He goes, what, God's not good now? Go walk. I'm like, I'm going to get wet. He said, so what? He said, we're going to save that spot for the pregnant girl or the elderly couple. I'm like, who does that? Right? Then I come out of Walgreens, and he's putting quarters in the meters for people's time that were running out. I'm like, dude, I ain't getting in the car with you no more. I ain't doing this. You know? And I know that I'm not on this earth to be alone. Not. And ever since I started to hear some fifth steps, these 12 steps have been designed to wake our spirits up. It's not about not drinking. If I had that conscious contact with God in step 11, not drinking and doing drugs becomes real easy. I know that I can't obtain or maintain or have any kind of spiritual development in my heart without you guys. My initial spiritual awakening was magnificent. When I sit down with a guy, I start taking him through the 12 steps. It just fortifies, intensifies, and strengthens that initial awakening that I had. And that's it. And then, so my 12th step is his first step, and so on and so forth. I'm not attached to sponsorship, lineage, all that stuff. We at our home group, we take Tradition 9 very, very seriously. We are not organized. We don't know who's making coffee on Saturday. We don't care. Someone's going to make it. We don't know who's chairing. Someone's going to chair. I know who's speaking. I get the speakers. I don't know if I even have anybody for Saturday night, but someone will speak. It'll be a 12-step message. And man, it's been an unbelievable journey. And it's language of the heart. I was so rigid with the big book, it didn't even help. I was 12-step except the drivers, except bus drivers. I'm like, yo, dude, if I see someone nodded or just close their eyes for one second, yo, you've been through the 12 steps out of the big book? And I ran around, and I was that dude, with big book strapped on my chest, an AA suicide bomber going to blow a meeting up. And I sound like that today. And I'll tell you what changed that. On a Saturday night, it was snowing out, and Nebraska's playing Oklahoma. And I just ordered a Santucci's pizza, get my sweatpants on, I'm in for the night, going to watch football, going to get a good night's sleep. And I hear this commotion out front of my apartment. Now, I was one of these recovery houses, so sometimes people just get dropped off on my porch with luggage. And I heard all this commotion out front, and I went outside, and there was this old, I'm old, but this guy was old. He was well into his 80s, and he was a big dude, and he was shaking like a leaf. And there was a young girl, and there's a bunch of young girls in the car, but the two that talked to me said, he's my father, and the other one said, he's my grandfather, he's drinking himself to death, and we don't know how to help him. I'm like, all right. So I bring him upstairs to my apartment, and he's vibrating. And if I could have walked somewhere to get him something, I would have. That's how bad he needed to drink. And he didn't look good. So I ran downstairs to call my sponsor. I called my friend Marie up, and they're like, you just hit him with step one. Just keep him occupied, feed him, and we'll look for a detox. Now, Saturday night, you know, the detox is back. It was hard to get in. He had no insurance. And I went back upstairs, hit him with step one. He wasn't buying anything. Went back downstairs, like, where you at with this detox? This guy's going to die on my couch. And I walk back upstairs, and he says to me, "I think I got it." I'm like, "You got what?" He's like, "I think I got steps one and two." I'm like, "Really?" He's like, "Yeah." He's like, "I'm like your cat." I'm like, "Dude, where is my cat at?" The cat was in my bedroom with the door closed. The doors never get closed. The cat owns the house. She just rolls wherever she wants. So he said, the combination of the wind, I had my window cracked open, the wind in her tail, the door closed behind her. I'm like, "Yeah." He said, "But if you listen real hard, you can hear her paws." I'm like, "Oh my God, this guy's drunk." I'm like, doing what he's saying. I walk over to the doorknob, I'm listening. And you can hear the cat hitting the doorknob with her paws. The doorknob's moving. He said, "I'm like your cat." I'm like, "Yeah." He said, "I got myself in there, but I need a power greater than myself, a power with hands to open that door." I'm like, "Holy shit, dude. That's the best description of steps one and two, and you're drunk." Never been in AA before. Never been in AA. And there was no big book. There was no big book open. He didn't know how to read, so I asked him. And there was no big book. It was just two drunks sorting out the truth. One drunk, another drunk, with no lectures. Not talking down to, but talking with. And ever since that day, that big book, I do stat work with a big book, but a lot of times we'll open it up, we'll put it down. Because if I tell somebody to read the first 164 pages that our book suggests, a guy like me who came in AA, I can't read. I couldn't read very well. I ain't reading 164 pages of anything that's just maxim. Right? So I'm like, I'll never do it. So I don't always do that because sometimes when you need help, but you're afraid you can't read, what people are going to think of you. Because we make it hard for people to come back. I don't know how it is up here, but we make it hard for people to come back, the people that relapse with time. And then we judge. And we make it hard for people to come back. And some people can't read and some people can't write. So we write for them and we read for them. You know? See, I have this thing that's called alcoholism that wants me dead. See, alcoholism, not alcoholism. And I have this thing inside my head where it centers. Like, I'm in the mental health chain. Like, think about that for a minute. Like we're all in the mental health chain if you've ever been in a psych ward. Then we're going to judge each other. Right? It doesn't make any sense. It's like trying to be a tough guy in rehab, sitting at the cool table. You know? We're all the same. And we make it tough for people to come back sometimes. And what we have is peace of mind. We don't, like, if I want another house, I'll get another job, I'll work hard, save money, I'll buy a house. What I was offered here was peace of mind. So you want a house in Cherry Hill? Get another job, go back to school. I'm no ambition right now. So I'm okay where I'm at. And where I'm at right now is taking care of two parents. My whole life makes sense today. You live life forward, it makes sense backwards. I can see exactly why I was never married, never had kids. Well, my sisters and brothers do. And they couldn't do what I'm doing right now. My mom and dad have to be in a home. And I get to watch. I get to be a son. That you guys gave me. You guys blessed me when nobody else would. And what we offer is peace of mind. And it's open to anybody. But once we get that peace of mind, whatever we do, let's just sit down with somebody and show them how we got it. Peace, guys. Thanks for letting me share.